Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Rick Rule and Ira Harris. Rick is the Senior Managing Director of Sprott Inc. and CEO of Sprott US Holdings. He is a leading resource investor specializing in mining, energy, water utilities, forest products, and agriculture. And he has originated and participated in hundreds of debt and equity transactions with private, pre-public, and public companies. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and also recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it.
Great. Rick, to start, we begin with your views on the current financial and economic environment and the disconnect that you see between Main Street and Wall Street.
Well, definitely. I think everyone sees the disconnect. Wall Street doing well, Main Street doing poorly. And I think that's a function of several things. Quantitative easing, of course, which is to say artificial liquidity. Artificially low interest rates, which depresses the price of various traditional savings products in favor of equities and dividend yields. And, of course, the direct buying of various securitized asset classes, including junk bonds and equities. Looking a little deeper, it's my belief that the recovery that we enjoyed from the 2008 collapse was driven as much by artificial liquidity and artificially low interest rates as it was any advances in trade or human productivity. So my suspicion is that it's likely that the gap between Wall Street and Main Street unfortunately closes in Main Street's favor rather than Wall Street's favor, which is to say that Wall Street probably declines rather than Main Street advances. I am still of the belief that we need to unwind some of the excesses that we enjoyed in the recovery, and I don't believe that the deleterious impacts on the economy that came about as a consequence of the precipitous shutdown of major parts of the economy by the COVID-19 virus have been priced into equity or debt prices yet.
Interesting. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, Richard, we've done a lot of these. And Dick, I only know of, and you know, I've never talked to him, but I certainly know Scott very well. You know, long time, especially trading as much metals as I have over the years. Dick's been around in the business a long time too. I actually, Dick, had the ability to learn quite a bit from Jim Sinclair, if you remember. He's still around, Jim, but he's a huge culture. So there's not. I'm absolutely of that mindset. Wall Street certainly did well at the behest of the Fed by design. Don't think there was anything but by design, because as this site that Richard that you're on is financial repression. When your financial repression is a course of policy, you know, people forget that, and it's no different than when Russell Long used it when he was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and he said the way tax policy works is everybody comes forward and says, "Don't tax me. Don't tax him, don't tax me, tax the person behind the tree." Well, financial repression works the same way. Somebody is going to pay the piper. And who's paying the piper? By design, because we've had Bernanke and Yellen and even Powell tell us, if you have savings and you're a saver and you're oriented that way, stop whining, because your grandchild or your neighbor or somebody else probably has gotten a job. Even though you're not getting anything on your savings, your house value is probably appreciated or at least stabilized. And if you happen to own some equities, you've done pretty well. So basically stop your crying. And that's financial repression. And, you know, really, the best work on it is, in fact, I pulled out some papers today because I'm getting ready to move and I'm going through all my stuff. And lo and behold, there was Conrad Reinhart's work on financial repression. And that's the world in which we live in. And everything that Dick laid out, who gets the worst of it? Those with savings, those who have built their retirement. And even if you have a 60-40, and because somebody who's a 60-40 investor, they're not running Tesla and Amazon. Those are high-risk stocks. Anytime you look at a stock, Tesla loses $150 in a day, $100 in a day. This is not stock markets, equity markets are supposed to be about capital. This has nothing to do with that. Where because of the Fed policies, things are just have run amok. It was interesting the other day that Bloomberg had an article citing Yellen and Bernanke saying that March, the responsibility of March and all the havoc in the bond market and everything else was due to hedge funds. No culpability, no responsibility of the Fed and the policies over the last 12 years for sure. None. It was the hedge funds. Well, I would rebut that, but I'll save that.
Rick, what are your thoughts on the mining sector in general? Maybe we begin with a focus on precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, especially today, with platinum up like $60 or $70 an ounce, I think. What are your thoughts on the precious metals and the supply-demand situation there?
Well, if you constrain me to the precious metals to begin with, my outlook is very bullish. I believe with specific regard to gold that the wind is really truly in gold's sails. In my experience, the determinant of the gold price is the market's faith or lack of faith in the ongoing purchasing power of savings instruments denominated in fiat currencies. And we talked earlier about the U.S. economy, and I think the same thing can be said for U.S. treasuries. They've been in a 35-year bull market, and they tend to move countercyclically to gold. I think that bond bull market is effectively over. The U.S. 10-year treasury, I think gold's principal competitor, yields 60 basis points in a currency that the Congressional Budget Office suggests is depreciating in value by 1.6% a year, which is to say if you give the money to the Fed for 10 years, they'll give you back less than 90% of what you gave them. Jim Grant goes so far as to call that return-free risk. With the wind in gold sales and the gold price increasing, the margins enjoyed by the gold producers increases. That is to say, their income statement improves, which improves their balance sheet, and a virtuous circle ensues. I have been in my life through two prior gold bull markets. I believe I'm in my third, and eight recoveries from oversold bottoms. I believe I'm in my ninth. And in every circumstance, the market has reacted the same. Gold moves first because it attracts fear buyers. Gold stocks move later after the primary move has been established by gold and after the benefit of the margin flows through to the income statement and the balance sheet. Silver moves after gold. And I think platinum, which is in some senses a different asset class, is moving now in sympathy, but we have to reserve judgment about that. With regards to the broader mining business, I'm of two minds. The first mind is that most of the commodity prices are below the incentive prices to build new mines or even in many cases to maintain sustaining capital investments in existing mines, which is bullish in the sense that it reduces the producer's productive capacity. On the other hand, industrial materials of all types are very economically sensitive, and I am nervous about the state of both the U.S. and the world economy for the next 3 or 4 years. So with regards to precious metals, I believe that we are in the early innings of a bull market. And I suspect that 4 years from now or 5 years from now, when we are done unwinding past excesses, that we'll have a truly spectacular rally in industrial materials. But I think people need to be prepared to wait for that.
I mean, in terms of copper, do you see potential drivers, though, in the near term? potentially from green energy and the whole COVID antiviral type of infrastructure requiring copper?
I do not. My own view of the copper market is that it is symptomatic of the broad economy. Certainly, not just electric vehicles, but the electrification of gasoline vehicles is extremely useful to the copper business. But if my unfortunate prognosis turns true, I think that total vehicle sales, irrespective of vehicle type, suffer over the next 3 or 4 years. Similarly, my suspicion is in many markets around the world, and even in many U.S. markets, industrial and residential real estate construction could suffer, which is also a major utilizer of copper. I certainly see over the 5 and 10 and 15 year period, the electrification of the world, including the primary electrical service, reaching 1.2 billion people around the world who don't have access to it today, as being a major driver of copper. So if you're asking me the question in a 5 or 10 year time frame, I'm extremely bullish. If you're asking me the question in a 1 to 3 year time frame, I'm much less bullish, irrespective of the use.
Interesting. And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, many things I agree with. I'll break a little bit on the copper because I see and I think what we saw come out of Europe yesterday, today, there is going to be massive, some massive infrastructure program. And, if, you know, again, we'll see the way politics turns out in the United States. But I think that the, as I listened to what came out of Europe, certainly going full force on a green initiative. Again, I was not a Christine Lagarde fan to begin with, but I think she has done a good job, especially because she stayed out of the way and let the politicians go at it. I do agree with Dick about the auto industry, but I don't believe it's going to be the auto industry because that's going to drive the next leg of it. You know, I agree on the electrification, but I think the grid gets built out faster, and I think wind certainly is a growing phenomenon, which uses a lot of copper else that comes with it. So yes, I agree with them on the long haul. I'm very bullish copper, but I think you'll get more out of it. I believe he's right to worry about the housing and the auto sectors, but I think that there'll be alternatives. That's again what makes the market. The other metals, I've been very bullish, and I think him and I find commonality as most of the people who come on. Wall Street wants to sell you the gold phenomenon always as an inflation hedge. But, you know, for me, and I've tried to educate people to it, it's a hedge against the credibility of central banks in a fiat currency world. The inflation will come, but you better hold it well before that. And I think people do because, again, remember we used to talk about the full faith and confidence of the of the U.S. Government. Well, and it's not just this period. It's certainly for decades already. We've lived well beyond our means. We've gotten away with it because of the reserve nature or what the French in the 60s was Jacques Rouff and the exorbitant privilege the United States had, and we were still living on it. But I think we're getting close to the end, and I think the world has grown tired of the sanctioning. And so, you know, Richard, I probably 3-4 months ago started talking about a bearish dollar scenario. After I dated it to when Wolfgang Schäuble did a pivot on May 24th and 25th. And I think I was on the following week with you. I was very bearish the dollar. And yet, you know, I was running into all kinds of dollar bulls, you know, citing at me the shortage of dollars in the world to meet all the borrowing. But I think today you saw a classic case because the dollar has been weak over the last 3-4 weeks. But today you saw how it manifests itself in many other ways. And I've maintained that the last leg of the equity rally will be based on a weaker dollar. Now people go, oh, the weaker dollar. But as I explain to people, if you go and look at the 200-month moving average on the euro, it's up at 125. So whatever weakness is taking place now is nothing. But I do believe it's helping the precious metals, especially the gold, because the gold for the last several years has been, and as I've blogged about, it's been long gold and short the euro, short the Swiss even, short the yuan, short the yen. It was against fiat currencies, but it held against the dollar. Now the dollar is the next leg to fall to push the gold to make all-time new highs. And we're just beginning. I think this concept of the dollar shortage is nonsense. I think if the Fed could talk about the dollar, they would wish for a weaker dollar, because a weaker dollar would help lift inflation, which is what they're trying to create, as central banks are. And it would relieve a lot of the initial pressure on repaying dollars, especially from the emerging markets. And if you get a commodity price boost with it, it'll alleviate even more of the stress on the emerging markets. So gold is a very, very important element here.
Rick, what are your views on the U.S. dollar and potential targets of the U.S. dollar, short, medium, long term, as well as on the precious metals, gold, silver, platinum? Do you have potential price targets?
At 67, I'm too old to tie myself to specific price targets anymore. I'm tempted to say my short-term track record is unblemished by success. Answering the question in a general sense, I think you need to say compared to what? I don't think that the U.S. dollar is absolutely strong, but I think compared to other fiat currencies, it's relatively strong. My friend Doug Casey once described the U.S. dollar as, quote, the prettiest mare at the slaughterhouse. And while I think that's a bit extreme, I think the strength that's exhibited in the U.S. dollar is not so much a function of the strength of the U.S. political system, the U.S. economy, U.S. society, but rather the relative weakness of the yen, the yuan, the euro, and the collection of baby dollars from around the world. I agree with the sentiment that the exorbitant privilege that we have enjoyed over the last 40 years is one that we have abused substantially. And people around the world are tired of giving us a carried interest, irrespective of our relative advantage. And my suspicion about that is that one of the beneficiaries will be gold. I want you to note, however, that I'm not one of these sort of dyed-in-the-wool gold bugs who believes in the collapse of the U.S. dollar, the collapse of U.S. society, and the return to the gold standard. I would point out that gold and precious metals-related assets are believed to comprise between one-third and one-half of 1% of total U.S. savings and investment assets. I have been told that the three-decade mean is between 1.5% and 2%. What that means is that if the forces that are challenging the U.S. dollar now continue, I believe it's likely that gold returns to mean, which would triple or quadruple demand for precious metals and precious metals-related assets in the largest savings and investment economy in the world. So the U.S. dollar relatively rather than absolutely strong, gold likely absolutely strong, using reasonably conservative demand parameters.
And very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm not a wild gold bug either. You know, as I tell people, I would like to go to sleep at night and have gold at $41.25. Then the world would be in a much better state, I can only play on the battlefield that is presented to me as an investor and trader and analyst. And I've had to, as Dick has and everybody else has, honestly, the malfeasance of policy especially in the United States, but of course around the world, which is why the dollar has held up stronger here, because while currency trading is always a relative, and that's what makes currency trading so difficult, is because the variables that you have to weigh, and they're always in flux, is it interest rate differentials? Is it political sentiment? There's so many different variables to go into it. And the United States has been. And you price in the fact that because the United States is by far the predominant element of exchange, as it's used all over the world, so many things, and so many things are priced in it, there's a natural demand for it. And as the IIF, the Institute of International Finance, and the BIS have been maintaining, the amount of emerging market non-government debt in dollars, which is private, has grown to 11, 12 trillion. And the ability to fund that and meet payments means that there's always a demand for dollars. Now, of course, when the dollar goes down, it makes that life easier for them. But that does provide an automatic backdrop to the dollar. But as I lock with some people of late, you know, everybody talks about, well, the dollar is the reserve currency, the dollar is needed for a transaction. That was true in 2008, and the euro went to 160. So all of these things are always in place. But when the sentiment shifts, and I believe the sentiment is shifting, because, you know, and I asked this question of everybody who invests, and this is not a hypothetical question. It's December 2020. The election is over. Employment is at 9% in the United States, and inflation is now headline inflation at 6%. Does the Fed raise rates? That is my operative mindset. And when I talk to people who have significant savings, they say, no, of course not. I said, okay, then you're making a point that the Fed is really trying to debase the currency. Because if you're not going to respond to that inflation, you're telling me that the currency valuation really doesn't mean anything to you. You are in an employment mode, and I believe the Fed is, because I think if you listen to Jerome Powell, over and over again, he uses this line when talking about the terrible situation in the employment market in the United States, for no fault of their own. Well, once you go to that mindset of no fault of your own, you're no longer a financial institution. You're a social justice mediator. And I think that's where the Fed has placed itself, which is why I'm as bearish on the dollar as I am.
Moving to the agriculture sector, Rick, what are your thoughts there? Do you see supply chain disruptions caused by COVID as affecting that in terms of, you know, pricing of agricultural commodities?
I do. I'm concerned about agricultural pricing given increasing economic nationalism around the world. Restraint of trade, in fact, makes everyone poorer, although it might enrich certain interest groups. I will say that despite a relatively cautious outlook on soft commodity prices, I have been a steady buyer for the last 12 months of very high quality farmland in the U.S. upper Midwest. The extent to which soft commodity prices have fallen, and hence farmland rents have fallen, seems to me to mean that that's probably the finest, quote, developed real estate asset class in the United States. High quality farmland in the upper Midwest with access to the biggest consumer, the best consumer market in the world, which is to say the United States, and access to the best highway in the world for transporting commodities and importing inputs, which is to say the Mississippi River, means that for me, one of the greatest long-term asset classes available to me in the context of risk and return, and also a lack of effort because I lease out the farmland, is high-quality farmland in the upper Midwest. Longer term, I'm also bullish on the inputs industry, which is to say fertilizers, fertilizer producers, and agricultural mineral producers. But for right now, given that I'm in the process of disposing of my passive interests in developed real estate, I'm replacing those developed real estate assets with very high-quality row crop land, irrigated row crop land with attendant water rights in the upper Midwest of the U.S.
And do you see any potential negative effects from issues of trade between U.S. and China and other countries?
Sure do.
On the agricultural sector.
Yeah, I mean, all sectors. The truth is that the world has gone crazy. The world ignores the lessons of the 90s. Reducing trade barriers makes everyone in the world richer and allows people to pay attention to what they do well relative to other people. And the sort of jingoistic response coming from all of the world's leaders, not merely the Chinese leaders, makes everyone poorer. I could tell you any number of things that could go wrong with my agricultural bet. I just think more things could go right than could go wrong, particularly price and value.
And you see the potential for China to source more agricultural commodities from South America, areas like Uruguay, Brazil, and Argentina?
Out on it. Absolutely. I think the Chinese would prefer us because they know that we're more reliable, higher quality suppliers. But I don't think that they will continue to see agricultural goods used as a potential weapon against them. The truth is that farmers around the world have constituted a very potent voting and lobbying bloc, and they've succeeded everywhere around the world, including particularly the United States, of enjoying really tremendous subsidies. So it is not unlikely that the Argentines, the Uruguayans, the Paraguayans, or the Brazilians would choose to compete with us on a subsidized basis. And to the extent that they were willing to sell crops like soybeans to China at less than total cost, I'm certain that the Chinese would be willing to accept that largesse.
And your thoughts, Ira?
I absolutely agree. I'm impressed that Dick is buying land there. I've been choosing to go and invest in Archer Daniel of late because they've been so unloved by the market, and their balance sheets are better than they've been in a while, and even without grain prices rising. But grain prices actually acted pretty well. Part of it, of course, the Brazilians brought in a record crop, and the real was at 5.6, 5.7, 5.8. The windfall to the Brazilian farmers was enormous. Soybeans were selling at record, all-time highs because of the depreciation of the real in Brazil. Yes, now their input costs went up, of course, especially ones priced in dollars. And I'm also bullish on fertilizers. I like Nutrien, but it's so badly run when you think about where potash was at, you know, which was one of the great Canadian companies. And then somebody, who was it? BPH was willing to pay $90 for it not that long ago. They've just been very managed, poorly managed. But I think the agricultural story, especially if I'm right in regards to the Fed and where prices, you know, start to respond, other asset prices besides paintings, automobiles, and some forms of real estate stop appreciating to the extent that they have, people look for other things like silver, gold, and I think ag prices will go with it. I am also involved in buying agricultural land in Uruguay. I'm in a pretty big deal down there, and I have been for years because they deal in the dollar, so you don't deal with the currency aspect. But the Chinese will shop everywhere. I think that nobody has higher standards of productions in the United States. But when that real is at 5 point, you know, when it reaches 50%, and the Brazilians have brought in such a massive crop, the Chinese will shop wherever it is. And they did some of it to thumb their nose at Trump, of course. I think the Navarro policies have really hurt the American farmers. armor, by the way. I think they were ill-timed because when did they go after the tariffs on the Chinese? Right when the Brazilian crop came in 2018. And you don't go after, it's like going on strike. The air traffic controllers going on strike in July when nobody's, you know, back then in the 80s when nobody was flying. You go on strike at Thanksgiving. And when the United States chose to tariff the Chinese, the alternative was already sitting there, which was a fresh Brazilian crop just brought in. Terribly timed. Bob Lighthizer, I expected a lot more from the others. I'll hold my tongue about, but Bob Lighthizer really, and I think that they hurt the American farmer. The American farmer has, and I've studied this for enough years, tried to build, you know, this goes back to the 40s, you know, on whether we were going to support Chiang Kai-shek. And the farmers were initially big supporters of mainland China. They didn't, you know, they've been courting China for so many years because, you know, a billion people need to be fed. And I think they lost market share, which was the worst part of that. But I agree with Dick, and I applaud his investments. You know, I go back and forth with a stock. You know, there are some publicly held companies that buy farmland that you can invest in, that pay dividends. So I'm looking at some of those. So to go with the mix, because I'm buying miners, and buying others. Hold on, I'm going to put you on mute for a minute because that's an important call for me. I'm sorry.
Great. And just a final question, Rick, what are your thoughts in general on the commodity sector and also using it as an asset class for investors over the coming decade?
My gut feel, no guarantee, is that after a long drought in mineral commodities and mining, that we're going to get two bull markets. The first one, the precious metals bull market, which I think we're in. It has legs. And then later, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, I don't know, a general industrial materials bull market, including things like copper and uranium and nickel and oil and gas. So my suspicion is that the next 5 years won't feature a bull market, but will rather feature two bull markets. For me personally, at age 67, I think it's a lovely way to approach my declining years with the wind in my sails, too.
Very interesting. And Ira, your final thoughts? He might still be on the call. So
I'm coming back.
Okay. Yeah. Just your final thoughts, Ira?
What?
Yeah.
On the whole gamut of everything we talked about?
Yeah, commodities in general and as an asset class for the coming decade. Yeah.
Well, you know, I like the commodity end because they've been so unloved, you know, and the better ones who have gotten their balance sheets cleaned up, you know, because Richard, I'm a big debt. You carry too much debt. You know, I avoid you like the plague. You have to show me some good faith that you're cleaning up your balance sheets. You know, if you find a story of a 3.5% dividend, you know, buying Freeport. I have dabbled in, of course, CEF for years on and off. And, of course, the grain companies. And you know, I'm an active trader in the futures market. So I think the platinum story is going to get interesting. And I say that only because if I go back, and platinum is, to me, a much more Asian precious metal than it is other places. And I think they have a history of when things are rolling in Asia, that they do buy platinum. If you go back and look at 2008, when China really stepped it up to help bail out the world, that's when we saw platinum all-time highs, the gold platinum gold spread made its all-time highs. So if Asia is starting to get itself together, I'm looking for that. But I would like to ask Dick if, you know, the shortages that we saw in March and April, especially. Well, I was on the CME board then. I'm not now, so I can discuss it a little more freely. But is he anticipating seeing any more of those shortages due to massive amounts of delivery taking place from large investors, be they sovereign wealth funds? And then I'm going to ask one more question, but whether he sees that.
At Sprott, in our physical precious metals trust products, we've added AUM very rapidly this year. And while there were widespread shortages of retail gold and silver product, 50-gram and 100-gram product, we were able to buy as much as $50 million worth of precious metals a day, admittedly in gold in the 400-ounce product, and admittedly more commonly in London. One of the problems that the U.S. physical market encountered was, first of all, unprecedented demand for retail mintages, but also the shutdowns of the refining and minting industry in Switzerland, which has made its living melting down 400-ounce product into retail sizes. So we had a strange circumstance. The other subject that you talk about is a little above my pay grade, which is to say the imbalance between the paper market and the physical market. You would know better than I with your familiarity with the exchange, but I know that there are some days when the paper market trades 100 times the total availability of in-system inventory for physical delivery. It's difficult for me, not being from that industry, to understand how that's possible. And the fact that it does occur is something that has kept me out of the precious metals futures market for years. I try, sometimes futilely, not to do things that I don't understand.
No, it's a great answer, and things that I do know. But the one last thing that I think about with the metals market, and it kind of surprised me that we haven't heard, with the IMF pressing to increase the amount of credit and cash they have available. In fact, it was interesting that Gang Yi, the head of the People's Bank of China, was out last week talking about ramping up SDRs, which of course plays to China. So when I read this piece in the FT, I said, wow, this is like Thomas Anderson and Kissinger talking back in 1974 about Europe trying to increase gold into the international system, because, of course, China would like to see a ramp up of SDRs because it would automatically support the yuan. But I'm wondering whether we are one day going to wake up and hear that the IMF is selling off a lot of its gold hoard. I know that under Article 4, I think there are some restrictions, but I keep waiting for the moment because that pile grows and grows and grows. Do you think about that?
A bit. The whole subject of the SDR is an interesting subject. It would seem to be an artificial construct that's made up of artificial constructs. Doug Casey once at one of our Sprott symposiums said, and this is a lovely quote, he said, the U.S. dollar is a... we owe you nothing. SDRs are a who owes you nothing, meaning that nobody is ultimately responsible for maintaining the value of the SDR. And I think that's a really important distinction to be made between a sovereign currency that you're nervous about, or an artificial construct made up of individual sovereign instruments.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Just wondering, Rick, how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Well, I'd love to give them an incentive to learn more about our work. Any of your listeners or subscribers who go to the web link www.sprottusa.rankings can input all of their natural resource securities, and I will personally rank them, backed up by the research staff of the Sprott organization, on a 1 to 10 basis, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I will also comment on individual securities where I think my comment has value. Further, I will include, and by the way, this is a no-obligation offer, no charge, free, I will include with that a 45-year gold mining equity index chart, the Barron's Gold Mining Equity Index chart, which I like because of its breadth and the length with which that index has been kept. And in addition, a 100-year commodity chart showing the valuation of the commodities asset class versus other asset classes. Once again, the web link is www.sprottusa.com/rankings.
Oh, that's super cool. And Ira, on your work.
Yeah. I will be dropping him a note shortly, I will say.
Okay.
I haven't been writing the notes from underground lately, but I'm in the middle of building out a website where I'm going to aggregate the treasure trove of all the FRAs I've done, of all the Santellis, of all the Credellis, everything I've written. So it'll be there, and I'll post all the new ones. I believe we're going to call Ira Harris Underground, and it'll be .com, and you'll be able to access there so people can find me. And, you know, I'm going into White Wave and to other places to be much more in real time. So people who have views and who want to discuss serious issues with no politics involved, because it's apolitical. We talk about ways to make money. Everything else is as far as I'm concerned. Keep your thoughts to yourself. I try to keep mine to myself, my political thoughts, but the ability to provide context and understand the nuance of the global financial system is what my strength has been. I'm the same age as Dick. I've been doing this for 43 years. I actually have academic teachings of it at the right time. And this was, what a propitious day this was, because we had the dollar down and we have major moves in the precious metals markets especially. So glad to be a part of it as always. And this is really a great honor to sit with Dick, because I have great respect for Sprout. They do, believe me, it's a place I go and read and visit, because the work has been exceptional over the years. So
thank you.
Great. Great insight. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.